This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hi, welcome to All in the Mind. I'm Lynn Malcolm, and today we're going to work.
Okay, gather.
There's good news and bad news. The bad news is Neil will be taking over both branches and some of you will lose your jobs. Yeah. Those of you who are kept on will have to relocate to Swindon if you want to stay. I know. Gutting. On a more positive note, the good news is I've been promoted, so every cloud. You're still thinking about the bad news, aren't you?
There's no good news, David. It's only bad news and irrelevant news.
Yeah, that's not a phrase, though, is it? I couldn't come out and go, oh, I've got some bad news and some irrelevant news.
You could have just told us about Neil. Kept your promotion to yourself.
Yeah, right. Should have told us the good news first, got
there
you happy.
There is no good news, David.
I think promotion is genuinely considered good news.
We're going to lose our jobs.
You're not all going to lose your jobs. God.
The excruciating manager, David Brent, from the BBC's comedy series The Office, demonstrating beautifully how not to communicate at work. All jokes aside, though, real-life scenes like these can deeply affect people's lives well beyond the office. When emotions run hot and self-esteem is threatened, our responses to one another can exacerbate already stressful situations. Add to that the delicate balance between our work and home lives, the rapidly changing technologies and work environments, and our life and job satisfaction can be threatened. Perhaps, as positive psychologist Dr. Martin Seligman says, we value the wrong skills.
Well, in general, we hire people by their talents, their verbal IQ, that they can do maths well and the like. But that doesn't produce job satisfaction. What produces job satisfaction is matching your strengths. And so if you've been hired by a law firm because you're a very good arguer, but your highest strength, say, is social intelligence, the law firm ought to be giving you 5 hours a week to schmooze the customers at lunch. Probably produce both more billing and a lot more life satisfaction. Interestingly, in New York, the major law firms are spending more on retention than they are on recruitment. We've entered an economy of life satisfaction, not an economy of money anymore in wealthy nations.
Dr. Martin Seligman from the University of Pennsylvania is a leader in the field of positive psychology. His work on happiness and optimism has inspired many around the world, including Peter Sullivan of the company Australian Business Training. Peter Sullivan says that these days we demand more from our working lives.
It's gradually changing, but the old hierarchical model of positional power no longer works in modern society. People don't respect authority, the churches, institutions like they used to. So people are wanting more of a slice of the action. People are wanting to be involved. So the organisations that get their people on board, empower their people, engage their people, are the ones that are producing the best results.
So, drawing on Dr. Martin Seligman's research, Peter Sullivan has spent many years working with organisations on effective ways to engage their employees. The key, he says, is to develop their emotional intelligence. Of course, efficiency and productivity are high on the priority list of any organisation. But Peter Sullivan says that if people learn how to shift their pessimistic, unhelpful patterns of thinking and to improve the way they manage their emotions, success will follow.
People have a thinking process. There's evidence we have 60 to 70,000 thoughts a day. But a lot of those thoughts are a real low state of awareness. And so part of what we do is to build people's awareness of that, to get them to be able to tune in, if you like, to that internal dialogue, because the data shows fairly clearly now that those thought patterns have a great influence on the way we feel. Those feelings or emotions then have a major impact on our behaviours.
Emotion is a difficult one in the workplace, isn't it? Because in a lot of ways there's no place for emotion in the workplace.
Yeah.
But you're saying that you can't have thinking without emotion.
Yeah, and you can't have emotion without thinking. Neuroscience has proven fairly conclusively now that if you take away emotion, you take away the ability to make decision. Goldman cites some research where they... lawyer who had a brain tumour, and when they'd cut that brain tumour out, they'd cut that link between his thinking brain and his feeling brain. The operation was successful to get rid of the tumour, but the thinking brain, basically the frontal lobes and the amygdala, is that's really the seat of emotion. So when they tested him on IQ, it hadn't changed. When they tested him on the law, it hadn't changed. But even simple decisions, like the doctor would ask him to come back and see him in 2 weeks and give him two or three alternative times to come back, the poor man couldn't make a decision about which time suited him. He had no preferences. He had no feelings. So neuroscience is saying now that most of the decisions we make are based on emotion that are rationalised later. So emotions, or as I call it, emotion, motion meaning movement, emotions move us. Now, some of the emotions move us in a constructive way, like excitement, passion, motivation. Those are the emotions that move us towards our goals. Some of the emotions, though, immobilise us. The anxieties, the fears, the angers tend to get in the way of what we're trying to achieve. So it's really trying to show people how to develop the right emotion to the right degree rather than get rid of emotions. And that's new for the workplace. But as people see how important this is, even senior management start to turn around and start to realise that human beings are emotional creatures. You can't leave your emotions at home, as the advice used to be. So as people start to become aware of this, they can use those emotions more constructively then.
Okay, my name's Roxanne Walker. I work for a company called Cerebos. We're in the fast-moving consumer goods industry. In about 2003, the business decided to branch out in terms of a category we hadn't worked in before, and that's in the retail area. So that meant that the sales team, the retail sales team in Australia, were facing a very big challenge, and a lot was riding on the success of that. What I started to sense was that they felt a little bit daunted by the challenge, and potentially they weren't setting themselves up in the best way to manage that challenge.
So in her role as manager of organisational development, Roxanne Walker introduced Peter Sullivan's training workshops to the staff to try and equip them with some skills to deal with the challenge ahead. They were faced with a rather unusual workplace experience.
Once we got people along to the workshop, for 2 days essentially, they'd be allowed to talk about the emotions. That's not always the first thing you're encouraged to do. You're often meant to put them in a box and put them to the side and not worry too much about them, just get on with the job. And in fact, often the hardest things they had to deal with, they were allowed to talk about. They're not going through it alone. So some of those feelings of it's just me and I'm feeling this and what am I going to do with that, it comes out in the open. So people then start to relax a little more into that as well.
The group was then given some activities to do. Roxanne Walker.
There's a tool called the ABC model. And what people are asked to do is catch themselves thinking in terms of the adversity. So if they've got a challenge, if they have to have a presentation to one of their buyers and it absolutely has to go perfectly, what are they saying to themselves about that presentation? So if they can start to verbalise the self-talk, and it might be things like, I must do this perfectly, I must not fail at this, they started to realise how much pressure they were putting on themselves and how that actually was hamstringing them in their ability to be freer and to go out and do a good job. So the tool gets them to identify the adversity, identify what belief they've got around that, and identify all that negative self-talk, and then challenge that. So is it real that you must do everything perfectly? Well, no, it's not. So what's a more appropriate way to think about that that gives you a lot more room to move? You haven't backed yourself into a corner. So you might then challenge that and start to say to yourself, I'd like to do a perfect job and I'd certainly work towards that. But if I don't, it won't be the end of the world and I will have done my best on the day. People are then asked to to look at their emotions and see what's happened to their anxiety state or their frustration state just by giving themselves a different frame of reference. But they're in charge of what they're telling themselves about their ability to cope. That's one key tool. And you used to hear people a lot in the workplace when they'd come back from sessions because they'd done it as a group, and it's always wonderful to have teams go through the process because they get a shared language. You'd hear people joking with each other and saying things like, I think you need to do an ABC on that. Which is a great, once you hear that in team meetings, you know that there's something there that they can help support each other through. Another tool was they were introduced to the term catastrophizing or awfulizing situations. And another tool that people were introduced to is what's called the reality chart. So on a scale of, let's say, 1 to 10, how catastrophic or serious is this situation you're facing? People soon realise that most things they face in the workplace are not likely to get over a 5, probably. Initially, they might be up around that, everything's up around a 10. But when you unpack a lot of that and start to compare it to other things that could go on in life, they realise that actually it isn't likely to be a 10. Making it a 10 makes it impossible to deal with. So again, back in the workplace, you would hear people say to each other, I think you need to put that on the reality chart. I think we need to get the reality chart out on that one. So they would do a lot of those things.
Roxanne Walker of Cerebos. As you can imagine, the issues that come up in these two-day workshops can be quite personal and emotional. So managing them requires skill and sensitivity. Peter Sullivan.
Part of it is to really make it relevant to them. One of the things we do in the workshop is get people to nominate what I call their hard-to-do but high-payoff activities. What are the things that are hard to do at work, but they really have a good payoff for yourself and the organisation? Then get the group to acknowledge a response to this question. So when you're dealing with a difficult situation, an adversity like that, what's the most likely human emotion? And they give it to me. Anger, anxiety, frustration, tension, stressed. I basically say something fairly challenging then. I said, well, when you get a gut full of negative emotion, what's the most likely behaviour that results from that? And they give me what I call the creative avoidance. It's a procrastination, put it off, or the overreactions, the hostility. Human beings tend to get overly upset and perform inefficiently when they fail or get rejected or when the going gets tough. So we start exploring if that's the way it is that average people react, then the point of difference that we can have is to manage those adversities or those tough points differently. And then we start to explore, well, why is it that if you've got a confront a difficult colleague on an issue, why is one person anxious and the other one angry? Same event, different emotion. And people start to realise it's this lens that we put on the world that's creating emotion. So the beliefs, the perceptions we have around the world are so habitual, they happen so quickly, there's a very low state of awareness. So we change them if appropriate.
Peter Sullivan of the company Australian Business Training. You're with All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and you may be listening online or on your portable MP3 player. I'm Lynn Malcolm, and we're discussing communication skills in the workplace and ways to better integrate our emotions with our thinking styles. Adrian Brennan has a career in the packaging industry, leading sales and marketing teams in the companies Amcor and Huhtamäki. He introduced the emotional intelligence training workshops run by Peter Sullivan to both companies when they were facing particular challenges. Initially, his staff was tentative.
I think there was a fair bit of scepticism because it seemed an unusual notion, having sales training which wasn't focused on the product or specific selling skills. It was more focused on working inside people's heads. So there was a lot of scepticism about, you know, is this a psychiatrist coming to talk to us? What's it all mean? And you know, what benefit will it be for us?
So just describe to me what happened then.
Well, it created a really powerful link in my mind of the importance of getting attitude right in order for behaviour to then be right and therefore actions to follow that can make people more productive and more efficient in what they do. the most striking thing was, "This has changed my life," was a comment that so many people made in terms of balancing what's important in life and any issues and problems that one has in life, putting them in context, I guess equipping us with more optimism skills, a view of the world that the world doesn't control my life, I control my life. Those kinds of skills, which I think a lot of the participants use greatly in managing the day-to-day issues that one faces in life, with a greater sense of purpose and less anxiousness and trepidation. So, yeah, it was very powerful.
And during the course of the workshops, did anybody just find it too hard to deal with? Was it just a bit too powerful for them and they couldn't go on with it?
No, there was a fair bit of emotion, though, in some of these workshops, and there was a great esprit de corps kind of sense came out of them in terms of the team strength, and so people were very supportive of each other in their non-work life, and if people were emotional, and this is, you know, fellows in their 30s and 40s, unused to showing their true emotions in front of work colleagues, particularly their teammates. So from that, there was a fair bit of emotion, but no one found it too hard. I think for quite a few people, it was a wonderful sense of relief from it, yeah.
So if we could just talk about a couple of common things that happen in the workplace, beliefs that people have about themselves.
Yeah.
For example, it must be quite common for someone to believe that, well, really basically, I'm not very good at this, I can't do this, but I'm just battling on and hopefully most people believe that I'm okay.
Yeah. Some people have this perfectionistic belief, and I mean, I was brought up this way. If it's worth doing, it's worth doing well. If I can't do it well, I won't do it at all. That's the way it tends to work out. Whereas what we're getting people to do is think, if it's worth doing, it's worth having a go. That means we might fail, we might do it less than the standard we want, but that's part of the learning curve. You never see a child who falls over sulk in the corner because they can't walk. They get up and they fall over again. But somehow as adults, we've learnt this thing, now I'm an adult, I'm not allowed to fail. Now I'm an adult, I'm allowed to get rejected. And therefore, that makes us avoid some of these challenging things about learning new tasks, new technology, or the constant change that we've got to go through. So if people can have self-acceptance that they are a fallible human being, they tend to be able to take more risks, take on more challenges, fail and step up to the plate until they learn how to do better. That's the turnaround, that people aren't devastated by failure. They see it as part of the learning process.
What about the victim mentality? That's a common one in workplaces.
Yeah. We're teaching people, I'm responsible for how I think and how I feel and how I act. Now, I'm not saying everyone will accept that responsibility. What we're trying to do is show them there is an alternative way of looking at things, that they can actually control their feelings and they can control their reactions. So now they have a choice. They can choose to be a victim if that's what they choose, or they can choose self-control and self-empowerment. Most people are sensible. They choose responsibility.
After one of the workshops, a participant told Peter Sullivan about how she turned a situation around with her newly acquired skills. She was a sales rep for a pharmaceutical company which was experiencing a lot of resistance from chemists to a new product they were marketing.
So one of the girls volunteered a situation of this chemist who was notorious in the industry, very difficult to deal with. He was fairly abusive, really hard to get on with. In fact, to the degree she said she used to have to rock backwards and forwards in the car to get up enough courage to go and see him. So she's worked before she's gone out to see him. She's done, we call it your ABCs. She's done her ABCs on that. She's got her head straight. She's got her thinking straight. And she related the story back to me in a later coaching session. She said, I just put my foot inside the door of his shop and he yelled some abuse at the other end of the shop. She said, in the past I would have been intimidated. She said, not this time. She said, I just yelled out back, is it me you don't like or is it the product you're having a bad day? Now that raised his awareness and he goes, oh, I'm having a bad day. Now in that split moment, because she had the right emotion, right degree, she made some very snap but very accurate judgments. She said to him, have you had lunch? He said, no. She said, I'll buy you a sandwich. He said, okay. She turned on her heels to walk out and he said, I'll give you the money. She said, no, I'll buy you the sandwich. She's just created a whole different scene. So that's an example of an individual who turned around a situation. And can you imagine what confidence that gave her? Not only in that situation, but the spillover, how she'd handle other situations in life.
inevitably, when people start talking about how they're feeling and how they're feeling about work, what also starts to happen is who they are as a person and their personal life starts to emerge. So you then start to hear about maybe some of the issues that people are facing at home because of the stresses they're feeling in the workplace. People are also allowed to talk about those issues and work with the tools and techniques to manage those situations as well.
Roxanne Walker. And when some of the skills picked up in the workshops are applied to people's personal and family lives, the effect can be quite transformative. Peter Sullivan.
A manager in a workshop, second morning, I often ask, can you reflect on what we went through yesterday? And even though it's early days yet, have you noticed any subtle changes or anything that's happened already? It's only overnight. And this guy said to me, he said, I went home from the workshop last night. He said, I've always been an angry person. He said, I got home, my wife was pacing up and down outside. And he inquired what she was doing outside, and she was very concerned about his reaction. He said, well, what's happened? She said, I've crashed the car. She expected him to really be angry and upset, and he said to her, are you all right? And she said, yeah. He said, oh, well, cars can be replaced, and walked inside. Now, he's telling me this on the second morning of the workshop, and as I'm watching him, there's a tear coming down his eye, and he said, out of all those years, I never knew how to control that anger. And because he got that clue of how to control that thinking and that feeling and that response, that's a profound change overnight. Now, that doesn't mean to say he's never going to get angry again, but that means that he's now got the ability to turn that anger up or turn it down or maybe sometimes not react quite like he used to in the past.
One of our account managers was going through a marriage breakup at the time of the course, and it was a very difficult time for him. He had a young family and it was a traumatic time, and he was emotional in our workplace. He had a short fuse and overreacted to small situations, so the fellow was under, you know, prolonged stress over his marriage situation. Now, after the course, the gentleman managed and took control over the breakup. It became an amicable separation. Within around about 9 months, he found another partner, has moved on with his life, is positive. And the specific message that he applied was one of not letting other events become permanent events. Another guy had a problem with a child who had a health issue, which he took greater control of and wasn't isolating that or trying to pretend that the health issue didn't exist, had a great sense of managing that and trying to balance that difficult part of his family's existence with, you know, proper enjoyable times and events with the rest of the family and indeed with the sick child. So it was just a matter of getting life in balance was the key that came through, yeah.
And I presume you went through the workshops yourself. What difference did it make for you? How did you find them?
It's certainly, I use it in a sense of managing, I guess, the challenges that a middle-aged fellow faces as he gets older in terms of your career, your family, your role in life seems to change, and at times it becomes marginal, and then there's a greater way of getting back on track quickly. So, yeah, it has changed my life.
Adrian Brennan. These sorts of training initiatives are now used by many organisations throughout the world and could well increase as employees face more change and potential stress in their working lives. One such training company in the United States is Adaptive Learning Systems, run by psychologist Andrew Chatet from the University of Pennsylvania. He was born and raised in Australia and started his career in the public service in Brisbane. But for the past 20 years, he's run training programs in large organisations in the US. He sees that in order to be successful in a changing work environment and to weather the storms of life, you need to be resilient.
For a long time, I think people have recognised how important resilience is. And with the ever-increasing pace of change in the workplace, it's going to become even more important. However, there hadn't been a lot of research on what makes it up, and the work that we've done has shown that it's actually made up of seven basic characteristics, that the resilient person is able to regulate their emotion when they're experiencing adversity. Secondly, rein in their behavior, keep that under control while they're in the midst of an adversity in order to achieve their goals. Thirdly, they're able to analyze the causes of their problem. They're able to work out exactly what's causing it and then take steps to solve it. And there's a very important thinking style that gets in the way of our being able to do that. They also have self-efficacy. They believe that they have mastery in the world, and they set about to show that they do. In addition, they're optimistic, but they're optimistic within realistic bounds. They're not Pollyanna. They see the situation reasonably, but because they have good problem-solving skills, they see their futures as being relatively bright. They also have empathy. They're able to understand their own motivations and the motivations of others. And finally, they have this desire to reach out. You know, I talk a lot around this country in speeches to companies, and I ask this question a lot. How many of you, if you had the chance, if I gave you the opportunity of never experiencing a negative emotion like anxiety or anger or sadness ever again, would be content to live your life at zero, feeling no positive emotion in return? And no one says yes. And people who have the ability to reach out deepen their relationships, they take on opportunities and challenges. Now that we know what the seven characteristics of resilience are, we can set about to boost them. And in a nutshell, what we found is possible is to go in, help people understand their thinking styles, the belief systems that they develop about themselves, their world, and their futures that develop over time from early childhood, equip them with the knowledge of what their styles are, and then teach them a series of skills that enable them to test the accuracy of those belief systems. Once their belief systems are more in accord with reality, even if that is a changing reality, then they're going to be more resilient in the face of that change.
Psychologist Andrew Chatte. Adrian Brennan, sales and marketing executive in the packaging industry, has seen the benefits, both personally and at work, of changing unhelpful thinking patterns and becoming more resilient. He thinks there's a growing role for training people in these sorts of skills, both for their work and their family lives.
I think undoubtedly, particularly I think for middle and senior executives who in large organisations and even in small organisations, there's a greater stretch on people in terms of their time away from home. There's a lot of people more involved in national roles, in a lot of travel and also international roles, where there's a great deal of your time is spent away from your family and your friends and your normal social networks. And in that situation, it's a lonely existence, an existence in a hotel or remote existence via a laptop. And I think that executives and anyone attending these courses has a greater sense of freedom of how they think and can open up about their desires and their thoughts in a more positive way. So, yeah, and in that process, the stress levels do, you know, dilute and reduce.
So in a sense, it seems like it's humanising the workplace.
Yeah, it certainly is. It's a tool that you can actually use for your family management. It's a counselling tool in certain applications. Any organisation, any large organisation or even small organisations where you've got a group of people needing to work together in a more open and honest way. I mean, it's not a panacea. It's just another kit in the tool bag of life.
Adrian Brennan. So what does the future look like for psychologist Andrew Chatte?
People won't be advertising a position being vacant. They're going to be advertising for a person who has a very flexible set of skills. So the best case scenario on that note is that people will be willing to change their attitudes about what it means to have a job and will find that as fulfilling as we currently do. I think the other thing is that we'll break down a lot of stereotypes about the man being the provider, for example. Families are struggling with work-home balance, and our work indicates that this hits women so much harder than it does men. So what I'm hoping is that there'll be a breakdown in those kinds of traditional roles. I believe that human beings have the flexibility to do that. So I've seen companies paying money for training and resilience that they never would have before. I've seen school districts becoming much more interested in embracing our program and others that are designed to help children become more resilient, more flexible in their thinking, more empathic, more willing to reach out, more willing to see change as an opportunity rather than as something that's necessarily negative.
Andrew Chatte, psychologist from the University of Pennsylvania and director of the training company Adaptive Learning Systems. He's also co-author with Karen Revich of the book The Resilience Factor, published by Broadway. That's all from us today. Thanks to producers Sherry DeLeese and Pauline Newman, and to sound engineer Judy Rapley. Don't forget to visit our website at abc.net.au/rn and scroll down the program list to All in the Mind. There you'll find links and more information about this and our past shows. And you can also listen to our recent programs online or download them onto your computer or MP3 player. Thanks for your company today. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Join me next week for All in the Mind when we explore the minds of children and some unusual approaches to helping them learn about themselves and the world. Bye for now.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.